That's where you were the other night when you wrote to me, dear woman, pinned in place by your suffering. I woke up at 3 a.m. because I could feel you pinned there so acutely that I, a stranger, felt pinned too. So I got up and wrote to you. My email was a paltry little email, probably not too different from the zillions of other paltry little emails you received from others. But I know without knowing you that those emails from people who had nothing to give you but their kind words, along with all the prayers people were praying for you, together formed a tiny raft that could just barely hold your weight as you floated through those terrible hours while you awaited your daughter's fate. If I believed in God, I'd see evidence of his existence in that. In your darkest hour, you were held afloat by the human love that was given to you when you most needed it. That would have been true regardless of the outcome of Emma's surgery. It would have been the grace that carried you through, even if things had not gone as well as they did, much as we hate to ponder that. Your question to me is about God, but boiled down to its essentials, it's not so different than most of the questions people ask me to answer. It says, "This failed me," and "I want to do better next time." My answer will not be so different either. To do better, you're going to have to try. Perhaps the good that can come from this terrifying experience is a more complex understanding of what God means to you, so the next time you need spiritual solace, you'll have something sturdier to lean on than the rickety, "I believe he exists only if he gives me what I want" fence. What you learned as you sat bedside with Emma in the intensive care unit is that your idea of God is a possibly non-existent spirit man who may or may not hear your prayers and may or may not swoop in to save your ass when the going gets rough is a losing prospect. So it's up to you to create a better one, a bigger one, which is really, almost always, something smaller. What if you allowed your God to exist in the simple words of compassion others offer to you? What if faith is the way it feels to lay your hand on your daughter's sacred body? What if the greatest beauty of the day is the shaft of sunlight through your window? What if the worst thing happened and you rose anyway? What if you trusted in the human scale? What if you listened harder to the story of the man on the cross who found a way to endure his suffering than to the one about the impossible magic of the Messiah? Would you see the miracle in that? Yours, Sugar. Part 3. Carry the water yourself. I'm often asked to give one piece of advice to people in their 20s. My advice is to go to a bookstore and buy 10 books of poetry and read them each 5 times. Why? Because the truth is inside. Also, to be about 10 times more magnanimous than you believe yourself capable of being. Your life will be 100 times better for it. This is good advice for anyone at any age, but particularly for those in their 20s. In your 20s, you're becoming who you're going to be, and so you might as well not be an asshole. Also, it's harder to be magnanimous when you're in your 20s, I think, and so that's why I'd like to remind you of it. You're generally less humble in that decade than you'll ever be, and this lack of humility is oddly mixed with insecurity and uncertainty and fear. You will learn a lot about yourself if you stretch in the direction of goodness, of bigness, of kindness, of forgiveness, of emotional bravery. Be a warrior for love. I'm often asked, do I know who I am? The answer is yes. It took me 30-some years, but I'm still getting used to myself. Beauty and the Beast. Dear Sugar, I'm an average 26-year-old man, exceptional only in that I'm incredibly ugly. I don't hate myself, and I don't have body dysmorphia. I was born with a rare blood disorder that has had its way with my body from a young age. It has left me with physical deformities and joint abnormalities. One side of my body is puny and atrophied compared to the other. I would not have been a beauty even without this illness, but it's impossible to remedy the situation with normal exercise and physical therapy. I'm also overweight, which I admit I should be able to fix. I'm not an unhealthy eater, but like anyone, I could consume less. I'm not ugly in a mysterious or interesting way, like a number of popular actors. I look like what I am, a broken man. My problem, and my problem with most advice outlets, is that there's not much of a resource for people like me. In movies, ugly characters are redeemed by being made beautiful in time to catch the eye of their love interest. Or else their ugliness is a joke, and they aren't actually ugly. In practical life, we're taught that personality matters more than physicality. But there are plenty of attractive, or at least normal-looking people, who are also decent human beings. What is there for people like me, who will never be remotely attractive, and who are just average on the inside? I'm a happy person, and have a very fulfilling life and good friends. I have a flexible job that allows me enough free time to pursue my hobbies, with employers who understand when I have to miss work for health reasons. But when it comes to romance, I'm left out in the cold. I don't want my entire life to pass without knowing that type of love. Is it better to close off that part of myself and devote my time and energies to the aspects of my life that work? Or should I try some novel approaches to matchmaking? My appearance makes online dating an absolute no-go. In person, people react well to my outgoing personality, but would not consider me a romantic option. I'm looking for new ideas, or if you think it's a lost cause, permission to give up. Thanks for your help. Signed, Beast with a Limp. Dear Beast, once upon a time, I had a friend who was severely burned over most of his body. 6 weeks after his 25th birthday, he didn't realize that there was a gas leak in the stove in his apartment, so he lit a match, and his entire kitchen blew up. He barely survived. When he got out of the hospital 4 months later, his nose and fingers and ears were burnt nubs, and his skin was more hide than flesh, like that of a pink lizard with mean streaks of white glazed over the top. I'll call him Ian. "I'm a fire-breathing monster," he roared to my kids the Thanksgiving before last, crouched beneath them near the edge of the bed. They shrieked with joy and fake fear, screaming, "Monster! Monster!" Ian looked at me, and then he looked at Mr. Sugar, and together we laughed and laughed. You know why? Because he was a fire-breathing monster. My kids had never known him any other way, and neither had their dad and I. I think it's true that Ian didn't know who he was before he was burned either. He was a man made by the fire. And because of the fire, he was also a rich man. He'd received a settlement from the gas company. He'd grown up lower middle class, but by the time I met him, when I was 27 and he was 31, he reveled in being a bit of a snob. He bought exquisite food and outrageously overpriced booze. He collected art and hung it in a series of hip and Tony lofts. He wore impeccable clothes and drove around in fancy cars. He loved having money. He often said that being burned was the best thing that had ever happened to him, that if he could travel back in time, he would not unlight that match. To unlight the match would be to lose the money that had brought him so much happiness. He had an incredible life, he said, and he was grateful for it. But there was one thing, one tiny thing. He was sorry he couldn't have love, romantic love, sexual love, love. "But you can," I insisted, though it's true that when I first met him, I was skittish about holding his gaze because he was, in fact, a ghastly sight. His body a rough yet tender landscape of the excruciatingly painful and the distorted familiar. I met him when I was a waitress at a swank French bar where he was a regular. He sat near the place where I had to go to order and collect my drinks at the bar, and as I worked, I took him in, bit by bit, looking at him only peripherally. We chatted about books and art and shoes as he drank $20 shots of tequila and ate plates of meticulously constructed pâté, and I zipped from the bar to the tables and back to the bar, delivering things. After a while, he became more than a customer I had to be nice to. He became my friend. By then, I'd forgotten that he looked like a monster. It was the strangest thing, but it was true, how profoundly my vision of Ian changed once I knew him. How his burnt face became instead his bright blue eyes, his scarred and stumpy hands, the sound of his voice. It wasn't that I couldn't see his monstrosity anymore. It was still there in all its grotesque glory. But alongside it, there was something else, something more ferocious, his beauty. I wasn't the only one who saw it. There were so many people who loved Ian, and we all insisted over and over again that our love was proof that someday someone would love him. Not in the way we loved him, not just as a friend, but in that way. Ian would not hear a word of it. To so much as contemplate the possibility of having a boyfriend was unbearable to him. He'd made the decision to close himself off to romantic love way back when he was still in the hospital. No one would love a man as ugly as him, he thought. When I argued with him, he said that I had no idea about the importance of physical appearance in gay culture. When I told him I thought there were surely a few men on the planet willing to love a burned man, he said he would make do with the occasional services of a prostitute. When I said I thought that his refusal to open himself up to romantic love was based on fear, and conquering that fear was the last thing he had to heal from the trauma of his accident, he said the discussion was over. And so it was. One night, after I got off work, Ian and I went to another bar to have a drink. When we sat down, he told me it was the anniversary of his accident, and I asked him if he would tell me the entire story of that morning, and he did. He said he'd just woken up and that he was gazing absently at a sleeve of saltine crackers on the counter the moment his kitchen flashed into blue flame. He was amazed to see the crackers and the sleeve disintegrate and disappear in an instant. It seemed to him a beautiful, almost magical occurrence. And then in the next moment, he realized that he was engulfed in the blue flame and disintegrating too. He told me about falling down onto the floor and moaning, and how his roommate had awakened but been too afraid to come to him, so instead he yelled words of comfort to Ian from another room. It was the people who'd been on the sidewalk down below and seen the windows blow out of his apartment who'd been the first to call 911. He told me about how the paramedics talked to him kindly as they carried him down the stairs on a stretcher, and how one of them told him that he might die, and how he'd cried out at the thought of that, and how the way he sounded to himself in that cry was the last thing he remembered before he lost consciousness for weeks. He would never have a lover. He would be happy. He would be sad. He would be petty and kind. He would be manipulative and generous. He would be cutting and sweet. He would move from one cool loft to another and change all the color schemes. He would drink and stop drinking and start drinking again. He would buy original art and a particular breed of dog. He would make a load of money in real estate and lose another load of it on a business endeavor. He would reconcile with people he loved and estrange himself from others. He would not return my phone calls, and he would read my first book and send me the nicest note. He would give my first child a snappy pair of ridiculously expensive baby trousers and sigh and say he loathed children when I told him I was pregnant with my second. He would roar at Thanksgiving. He would crouch beneath the bed and say that he was a fire-breathing monster, and he would laugh with all the grown-ups who got the joke. And not even a month later, a week before Christmas, when he was 44, he would kill himself. He wouldn't even leave a note. I've thought many times about why Ian committed suicide, and I thought about it again when I read your letter, Beast. It would be so easy to trace Ian's death back to that match, the one he said he would not unlight if he could, the one that made him appear to be a monster and therefore unfit for romantic love, while also making him rich and therefore happy. That match is so temptingly symbolic, like something hard and golden in a fairy tale that exacts a price equal to its power. But I don't think his death can be traced back to that. I think it goes back to his decision to close himself off to romantic love, to refuse to allow himself even the possibility of something so very essential because of something so superficial as the way he looked? And your question to me, the very core of it, is circling around the same thing. It's not, will I ever find someone who will love me romantically? Though in fact, that question is there, and it's one I'll get to. But rather, am I capable of letting someone do so? This is where we must dig. You will never have my permission to close yourself off to love and give up. Never. You must do everything you can to get what you want and need, to find that type of love. It's there for you. I know it's arrogant of me to say so, because what the hell do I know about looking like a monster or a beast? Not a thing. But I do know that we are here, all of us, beasts and monsters and beauties and wallflowers alike, to do the best we can. And every last one of us can do better than give up. Especially you. Anyone who has lived in the world for 26 years, looking like what he is, quote, a broken man, is not just average on the inside. Because of that, the journey you take to find love isn't going to be average either. You're going to have to be brave. You're going to have to walk into the darkest woods without a stick. You aren't conventionally attractive, or even, as you say, normal-looking. And as you know already, a lot of people will immediately X you out as a romantic partner for this reason. That's okay. You don't need those people. By stepping aside, they've done you a favor. Because what you've got left, after the fools have departed, are the old souls and the true hearts. Those are the uber-cool sparkle rocket mind-blowers we're after. Those are the people worthy of your love. And you, my dear, are worthy of them. By way of offering up evidence of your didn't-even-get-started defeat, you mentioned movies in which, quote, the ugly characters are redeemed by being made beautiful in time to catch the eye of their love interest. But that's not a story I buy, hun. We are way more ancient than that. We have better, truer stories. You know that fairy tale called Beauty and the Beast? Jean-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont abridged Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve's original La Belle et la Bête in 1756, and it is her version that most of us know today. There are many details that I'll omit here, but the story goes roughly like this. A beautiful young woman named Belle lives with a beast in a castle. Belle is touched by the beast's grace and generosity and compelled by his sensitive intelligence. But each night, when the beast asks Belle to marry him, she declines because she's repulsed by his appearance. One day she leaves the beast to visit her family. She and the beast agree that she'll return in a week. But when she doesn't, the beast is bereft. In sorrow, he goes into the rose garden and collapses. That is how Belle finds him when she returns, half dead from heartbreak. Seeing him in this state, she realizes that she truly loves him, not just as a friend, but in that way. And so she professes her love and weeps. When her tears fall onto the beast, he is transformed into a handsome prince. What I want you to note is that Belle loved the beast when he was still a beast, not a handsome prince. It is only once she loved him that he was transformed. You will be likewise transformed, the same as love transforms us all. But you have to be fearless enough to let it transform you. I'm not convinced you are just yet. You say that people like you, but don't consider you a romantic option. How do you know that? Have you made overtures and been rebuffed, or are you projecting your own fears and insecurities onto others? Are you closing yourself off from the possibility of romance before anyone has the chance to feel romantically toward you? Who are you interested in? Have you ever asked anyone out on a date? Or to kiss you? Or to put his or her hands down your pants? I can tell by your articulate, honest, sad, strong letter that you are one cool cat. I'm pretty certain based on your letter alone that a number of people would consider putting their hands down your pants. Would you let one of them? If the answer is yes, how would you respond once he or she got there? I don't mean to be a dirty smartass, though I am in fact a dirty smartass. I mean to inquire without diminishing the absolute reality that many people will disregard you as a romantic possibility based solely on your appearance, about whether you've asked yourself if the biggest barrier between you and the romantic hot monkey love that's possible between you and the people who will, yes, without question, be interested in you, is not your ugly exterior, but your beautifully vulnerable interior. What do you need to do to convince yourself that someone might see you as a lover instead of a friend? How might you shut down your impulse to shut down? These questions are key to your ability to find love, sweet pea. You asked me for practical matchmaking solutions, but I believe once you allow yourself to be psychologically ready to give and receive love, your best course is to do what everyone who is looking for love does. Put your best self out there with as much transparency and sincerity and humor as possible, both online and in person, with strangers and among your circle of friends. Inhabit the beauty that lives in your beastly body and strive to see the beauty in all the other beasts. Walk without a stick into the darkest woods. Believe that the fairy tale is true. Yours, Sugar. I chose Van Gogh. Dear Sugar, I was sexually assaulted at 17. I was naive and I didn't understand it. Anxiety became a deep part of my life, and it almost pulled me under. Trudging onward was all I could do. I've made peace with it. I have been dating a great guy for about a year and a half. How do I tell him about my sexual assault? Do I need to? It doesn't affect my relationship or my day-to-day life, but it was a formative and intense thing, and therefore played an important role in shaping who I am today. We've been through some emotionally intense events, so I know he's capable of hearing it. I would love your advice. Signed, Over It. Dear Over It, I have a friend who is 20 years older than me, who was raped 3 different times over the course of her life. She's a talented painter of some renown. When I learned about the rapes she'd endured, I asked her how she recovered from them, how she continued having healthy sexual relationships with men. She told me that at a certain point, we get to decide who it is we allow to influence us. She said, I could allow myself to be influenced by 3 men who screwed me against my will, or I could allow myself to be influenced by Van Gogh. I chose Van Gogh. I never forgot that. I think of that phrase, I chose Van Gogh, whenever I'm having trouble lifting my own head up. And I thought of it when I read your letter Over It. You chose Van Gogh, too. Something ugly happened to you, and you didn't let it make you ugly. I salute you for your courage and grace. I think you should tell your boyfriend about your sexual assault, and I think you should tell it straight. What happened, how you suffered, how you came to terms with the experience, and how you feel about it now. You say this terrible experience no longer impacts your day-to-day life, but you also say it played an important role in shaping who you are. The whole deal about loving truly and for real and with all you've got has everything to do with letting those we love see what made us. Withholding this trauma from your boyfriend makes it bigger than it needs to be. It creates a secret you're too beautiful to keep. Telling has a way of dispersing things. It will allow your lover to stand closer inside the circle of you. Let him. Yours, Sugar. The Other Side of the Pool. Dear Sugar, my 2 grown sons, ages 35 and 23, have returned to the nest, my home. They didn't ask. They simply showed up. My younger son is going to college, but he hates it. He wants the financial aid money. He drinks, blows weed, watches daytime TV, and plays computer games. His 18-year-old girlfriend and their baby are going to move in soon to fill out my already crowded spare bedroom. Since the baby is my new grandchild, I'm kind of excited about that. My older son is also enrolled in college and is taking it seriously and getting good grades, but he drinks and is very moody and sarcastic to me. I've cleaned out my savings to make his car payments and cover his bills. I'm a recovering alcoholic and have my own moods. I'm supporting the household with the dollars I can eke out as a writer, which is to say, not much. But but I'm resourceful. I use coupons and shop at thrift stores. My question is, how do I get these men launched in life and out of my house? I want to write in privacy, pace the room in my underwear, working out dialogue, research, sing, shake my ass, practice yoga, read, find my things where I left them the night before, enjoy a fragrant guest bathroom where the toilet seat remains down, eat tofu and oranges, drink green tea, not chips and hoagies. I don't want to have mayonnaise spilled down the front of the kitchen cabinet. I want to cry over romantic movies and hear Mozart's greatest hits, pay my bills, buy some bangle bracelets. I'm stuck, sugar. I love these kids. Their father, my ex-husband, died last year, and I understand the loss and confusion my sons feel about this. I know the economy is hard. I recognize that building a life, finding someone to love, enjoying life's many pleasures, is hard work. But I'm afraid my sons are failing in the job of getting on with it. I'm afraid I won't be able to cover all the expenses. I'm afraid that what I want as I prepare to enter old age won't be attainable. I'm afraid my sons will never launch. I'm crowded with fear. What do you think I should do? Crowded. Dear Crowded, one of my earliest memories is also one of my most vivid. I was 3 and enrolled in a swimming class at the local YMCA. On the first day, I, like all the 3-year-olds, was issued what we called a bubble, a flotation device that buckled on around the shoulders and waist and featured an object about the size and shape of a football that was pressed up against my back. This would allegedly keep me afloat. "Don't worry," my mother assured me over and over again. "Your bubble will hold you up." She said the same thing in various tones, with various degrees of patience and exasperation, week after week, as I clung to the side of the pool. But her words meant nothing. I would not be persuaded to join my peers in the water. I was terrified. I felt certain that if I let go of the wall, I would immediately drown, bubble or not. So each week I stubbornly stationed myself there while watching my classmates kick themselves around the pool. "See?" my mother would point to them excitedly when they passed. But I would not be swayed. On the final day of the class, the parents were meant to swim with their children. My mother put on her suit and sat beside me on the side of the pool, and together we dangled our feet in the water, watching the other kids perform the techniques they'd learned. When it was nearly time to leave, she said to me, "How about we just go in the water together? I'll hold you." I was fine with that. That's how I'd always gone into the water, clinging to my mother, who might gently splash me or bob me up and down until I laughed. So into the water we went. When we got out to the middle of the pool, she convinced me to let her hold only my hands while dragging me through the water. And though while she did this, I repeatedly begged, "Don't let me go, don't let me go," and she repeatedly promised, "I won't, I won't." In one sudden burst of power, she swirled me around and flung me away from her. My memory of how it felt to glide through the water without my mother is still so fresh, so visceral, even though it was 40 years ago. The sensations were both physical and intellectual. How strange and glorious it was to be anchored to nothing, to be free in some particular way for the first time in my life. How quickly I shifted from the shock of my mother's betrayal to the terror of my new reality, to the pure delight of how it felt to swim. My mother had been right. My bubble held me up. Of course, I didn't want to get out of the pool then. I swam around and around, circling my mother as we laughed with joy and surprise, both of us wishing we'd known sooner that all it took for me to do this was for her to let me go. I swam so long that my mother got out while I swam to and fro, from where she sat on one side of the pool all the way over to the other side of the pool, which seemed then impossibly far. When I got there, I'd look back at her and yell, "I'm on the other side of the pool." And she'd smile and say, "Yes, there I was, all the way over on the other side of the pool." And then I'd swim back to her and do it all over again. I think you need to do a little something like my mom did after her weeks of patience, Crowded. You need to fling your sons away from you so they can learn how to swim. You must tell them to move out. They are not ill. They are not in crisis. They are not children. They are two adults capable of providing for themselves. Their bubbles will hold them up. You must demand that they trust that. When you tell your sons you will no longer allow them to live in your house, it will probably come as a surprise to them. It is a shock to be flung away from the very person to whom one has clung to for so long, but I'm quite certain it will turn out to be a healthy shift for all of you. Much as your sons no doubt love you, it seems clear to me that they don't see you as truly separate from them. Your needs matter little because it barely occurs to them that you have any. They moved into your house without asking you because they don't really consider that house yours. They believe it's theirs, too, that they have a right to it because it belongs to you, their mother. Theirs. They have not separated themselves from you on a fundamental level. They want you to leave them alone and to refrain from telling them how to live, but they have not yet perceived that you have a life of your own too, one that their presence at this point thwarts. They don't yet see you as an adult with a right to privacy and self-determination. This is not because they are bad men. It's that they need to go through that final stage of development, one in which the child truly separates from the parent, and it seems they need a push that only you can give. Remember when they were toddlers and everything was, do it myself, do it myself? I've never met your sons, but I'll guess that like most kids, at a certain stage of development, it was important for them to perform tasks that you'd once done for them, opening doors, buckling seatbelts, zipping up jackets. Children demand such things because they must, because their very survival depends on their ability to learn how to be self-sufficient. For a mix of reasons I can only guess at, emotional immaturity, financial stress, your own enabling tendencies, grief over their father, youthful self-absorption. Your sons have resisted the final stages of the do-it-myself impulse that begins in the toddler years. They've realized it's easier to let you do it for them. By asking them to move out of your house, you're telling them you know that they can do this too. You're doing your sons a service by asking them to leave. You're demonstrating your faith in the natural course of things, that they are now capable of thriving without you. Evicting your sons from your house does not mean you are evicting them from your life. As their mother, what you owe them is unconditional love, emotional support, and respect. Asking them to move out of your house does not mean you will not help them in any number of ways over the years. Your son who's recently become a father, for example, may particularly need your support as a caregiver to your grandchild. The point is, you get to choose what you wish to provide when it comes to money and resources now. You raised those boys into men. You paid your dues. It's time for you to allow your sons to pay theirs. It's only once you fling them away that they can do this, that they can see how it feels to float, how you look to them from that distance on the other side of the pool. Yours, Sugar. The Truth That Lives There. Dear Sugar, I'm a 26-year-old woman who has been married for 9 months. My husband is 40. His wedding proposal was terribly romantic, like something out of a movie starring Audrey Hepburn. He's kind and funny. I do love him. And yet, he's only the second person I've been in a serious relationship with. Throughout the wedding planning process, I had second thoughts about settling down so young, but I didn't want to hurt or embarrass him by calling off the wedding. There are so many experiences I fear I'll miss out on by staying married to someone older. I want to apply for the Peace Corps, live all over the country, teach English in Japan, and yes, date other people. These are all things I was giving up when I said I do, but it's only hitting me now. I feel stuck. I want to leave, but I'm also terrified of hurting my husband, who has been so good to me and who I consider my best friend. Sugar, I've always played it safe. I picked the safe major, accepted the safe job, went ahead with the wedding. I'm terrified that leaving my husband will mean I finally have no excuse for why I'm not living the bold, experience-rich life I've always dreamed of. Sugar, please help me. Playing it safe. Dear Sugar, I'm a messed up woman. I bear the scars of much emotional abuse, some physical abuse, and one sexual assault. I have an addictive personality, flirt with anorexia, OCD, and I don't know what it's like to live without the flush of adrenaline in my body from chronic stress. I'm vain, self-absorbed, depressed, angry, self-loathing, and lonely, routinely. I was raised to think I was a filthy person, and God would only love me if I behaved. I mostly behaved. Then I met a man who told me God would love me anyway. I converted to fundamental Christianity and married the man. I was 18. That was 7 years ago. He is, for most intents and purposes, a good man. He means well and he loves me, but he suffers from the faults of most young men in our religion, the head of household syndrome. I'm expected to be a certain way, so I am. He doesn't realize he does this unless I tell him, and I've stopped bothering to tell him after so many years. But I'm not really that person, and the longer we're married, the more trapped and broken I feel about burying the real me, the messed up person I already described. He knows all my scars, but as a Christian, he doesn't understand mental illness at all. He pleads with me to trust God more. He says if I just try harder, he knows I can get better. He says I have such potential. I don't blame him for my discontent entirely. We were told we were too young to marry. But despite my own misgivings, I married to prove everyone wrong. We're both incredibly stubborn. I thought if I could be the person I was supposed to be, I would make myself okay. I would be better. It was a lie I told myself. I love him. I don't want to hurt him. But I don't know how to stop this charade, how to heal, or how to make him understand. I spent a week in a psych ward for depression a few years ago because I just needed to put the brake on and knew that the only way to get through to him was something drastic. Either I killed myself or I got help. I got help. However, the mask was back in place as soon as I was released, and my therapy was a joke. Nothing changed, and I feel myself reaching the breaking point again. I no longer have any urge to kill myself and can recognize my own warning signs, but I do need a break. Pretending is tiring. My health has suffered over the past few months. We finally bought our first house, and most days I sit around it weeping. I have thought of leaving so many times, but I don't want to hurt him. He's worked hard to allow me to stay home, though we have no children. If I left, he would become a pariah in our church community, where we are currently leaders. I don't want to do that to him. He does not believe in divorce unless I cheated on him. I no longer know what I believe. I've tried talking about how I feel before, but we're on two different planets. If I confronted him about how I feel now, he would feel betrayed by me, and I would feel horrible. He in the past has refused counseling, saying, my life is great, and we don't need it, even if I do. My fear is that, as usual, if I say something, we seem better for a time, and the cycle continues. I'm tired of the cycle. Where is the line, sugar? When you want the life you have to work, but it doesn't, and you aren't sure it can, and when you want a completely different life, too, which way do you go? Do I stay and rub myself out until maybe I'm the person I was always expected to be? Is this just what it means to be an adult? I never had a good example of a marriage until I was already married, in my in-laws, and we do not look like them. But could we, in time? How long do you try? Signed, Standing Still. Dear Sugar, I'm a woman in my late 20s who has dated the same guy for almost 3 years and lived with him for almost a year. All of my friends seem to be getting married, and I feel as though I should be considering marriage too. However, the thought of marrying my boyfriend makes me feel panicky and claustrophobic. He has mentioned once the possibility of us tying the knot, and I think he sensed I was not comfortable discussing it, so he didn't mention it again. I've not had many boyfriends, one steady relationship in high school, a few very short-lived relationships post-college, and now this one. My boyfriend is the sweetest person you will ever find, and we have some things in common. But I find myself fantasizing about dating other people. I find my respect for my boyfriend waning. I don't know if this is a temporary feeling or if this relationship is not meant to continue for the long term. I'm bored with him, and I'm afraid I will get more bored as time goes on. I'm also afraid that there really is no one better out there for me, that I should be grateful for what I have, and that anyone I would be seriously interested in would be unlikely to be interested in me in the same way. Seems to be the case, judging from experience. I hate feeling like I'm doing my boyfriend a disservice by not loving him as much as he loves me. What do I do, sugar? Signed, claustrophobic. Dear women, I chose to answer your letters together because placed alongside each other, I think they tell a story complete enough that they answer themselves. Reading them, it occurred to me that allowing you to read what others in a similar situation are struggling with would be a sort of cure for what ails you, though of course I have something to say about them too. I struggled with these very questions mightily in my own life when I was married to a good man whom I both loved and wanted to leave. There was nothing wrong with my ex-husband. He wasn't perfect, but he was pretty close. I met him a month after I turned 19, and I married him on a rash and romantic impulse a month before I turned 20. He was passionate and smart and sensitive and handsome and absolutely crazy about me. I was crazy about him too, though not absolutely. He was my best friend, my sweet lover, my guitar-strumming, political rabble-rousing, road-tripping sidekick, the co-proprietor of our vast and eclectic music and literature collection, and daddy to our two darling cats. But there was in me an awful thing, from almost the very beginning, a small, clear voice that would not, no matter what I did, stop saying, go. Go, even though you love him. Go, even though he's kind and faithful and dear to you. Go, even though he's your best friend and you're his. Go, even though you can't imagine your life without him. Go, even though he adores you and your leaving will devastate him. Go, even though your friends will be disappointed or surprised or pissed off or all three. Go, even though you once said you would stay. Go, even though you're afraid of being alone. Go, even though you're sure no one will ever love you as well as he does. Go, even though there is nowhere to go. Go, even though you don't know exactly why you can't stay. Go, because you want to. Because wanting to leave is enough. Get a pen. Write that last sentence on your palm, all three of you. Then read it over and over again until your tears have washed it away. Doing what one wants to do because one wants to do it is hard for a lot of people, but I think it's particularly hard for women. We are, after all, the gender onto which a giant here-to-serve button has been eternally pinned. We're expected to nurture and give by the very virtue of our femaleness, to consider other people's feelings and needs before our own. I'm not opposed to those traits. The people I most admire are in fact nurturing and generous and considerate. Certainly, an ethical and evolved life entails a whole lot of doing things one doesn't particularly want to do, and not doing things one very much does, regardless of gender. But an ethical and evolved life also entails telling the truth about oneself and living out that truth. Leaving a relationship because you want to doesn't exempt you from your obligation to be a decent human being. You can leave and still be a compassionate friend to your partner. Leaving because you want to doesn't mean you pack your bags the moment there's strife or struggle or uncertainty. It means that if you yearn to be free of a particular relationship and you feel that yearning lodged within you more firmly than any of the other competing and contrary yearnings are lodged, your desire to leave is not only valid, but probably the right thing to do, even if someone you love is hurt by that. It took me ages to understand this. I still can't entirely explain why I needed to leave my ex. I was tortured by this very question for years, because I felt like such an ass for breaking his heart, and I was so shattered I'd broken my own. I was too young to commit myself to one person. We weren't as compatible as we initially seemed. I was driven by my writing, and he begrudged my success in equal measure to his celebration of it. I wasn't ready for long-term monogamy. He grew up upper middle class, and I grew up poor, and I couldn't keep myself from resenting him for that. My mother died, and my stepfather stopped being a father to me, and I was an orphan by the age of 22 and reeling in grief. All of these reasons are true enough in their specificity, but they all boil down to the same thing. I had to leave. Because I wanted to. Just like all of you do, even if you aren't ready to do it yet. I know by your letters that you each have your own lists, but all those words on all of those lists boil down to one that says go. I imagine you'll understand that at some point. That when it comes down to it, you must trust your truest truth, even though there are other truths running alongside it, such as your love for the partners you want to leave. I'm not talking about just up and walking out on your partners the moment the thought occurs to you. I'm talking about making a considered choice about your life. I desperately wanted to not want to leave my ex-husband. I agonized in precisely the ways you are agonizing, and I shared a fair piece of that struggle with my ex. I tried to be good. I tried to be bad. I was sad and scared and sick and self-sacrificing and ultimately self-destructive. I finally cheated on my former husband because I didn't have the guts to tell him I wanted out. I loved him too much to make a clean break, so I botched the job and made it dirty instead. The year or so I spent splitting up with him after I confessed my sexual dalliances was wall-to-wall pain. It wasn't me against him. It was the two of us wrestling together neck deep in the muckiest mud pit. Divorcing him is the most excruciating decision I've ever made. But it was the wisest one, too. And I wasn't the only one whose life is better for it. He deserved the love of a woman who didn't have the word go whispering like a deranged ghost in her ear. To leave him was a kindness of a sort, though it didn't seem that way at the time. It wasn't until I'd been married to Mr. Sugar a few years that I truly understood my first marriage. In loving him, I've come to see more clearly how and why I loved my first husband. My two marriages aren't so different from each other, though there's some sort of magic sparkle glue in the second that was missing in the first. Mr. Sugar and my ex have never met, but I'm certain if they did, they'd get along swimmingly. They're both good men with kind hearts and gentle souls. They both share my passions for books, the outdoors, and lefty politics. They're both working artists in different fields. I argue with Mr. Sugar about the same amount as I did with my former husband, at a comparable velocity, about similar things. In both marriages, there have been struggles and sorrows that few know about and fewer still were and are capable of seeing or understanding. Mr. Sugar and I have been neck deep together in the muckiest mud pit, too. The only difference is that every time I've been down there with him, I wasn't fighting for my freedom, and neither was he. In our nearly 16 years together, I've never once thought the word go. I've only wrestled harder so I'd emerge dirty but stronger with him. I didn't want to stay with my ex-husband, not at my core, even though whole swaths of me did. And if there's one thing I believe more than I believe anything else, it's that you can't fake the core. The truth that lives there will eventually win out. It's a God we must obey, a force that brings us all inevitably to our knees. And because of it, I can only ask the three of you the same question. Will you do it later, or will you do it now? Yours, Sugar. Too much paint. Dear Sugar, up until a few months ago, my dating life was always sort of black and white. I've either been in a serious monogamous relationship, or I've dabbled around with one-night stands or random, no-strings-attached romps with platonic male friends. Recently, I've entered the strange and magical world of casual, non-monogamous dating. I've met a few guys who I enjoy on an intellectual level, as well as sexually. I'm learning a lot about my own sexuality through interacting with distinctly different partners, and I feel like I'm finally discovering that part of myself, which is awesome. Maybe it's because I'm new to this whole non-monogamous scene, and it just doesn't come naturally to me yet. But sometimes I find myself feeling completely overwhelmed by the prospect of juggling these different men. One week, I went out with Bill on Monday, saw Jack on Tuesday, then had a no-strings-attached encounter with a friendly ex on Wednesday. It was lovely getting laid 3 nights in a row, but getting laid by 3 different dudes sort of made my head spin. I don't want to have anonymous and or completely meaningless sex, but neither do I want to home in on one guy and pursue a serious relationship right now. How can I navigate these new waters without giving myself a nervous breakdown? Am I obliged to tell the guys I'm seeing that they're not the only dude I'm sleeping with? Man juggler. Dear man juggler, I'll answer the easy question first. Yes, you are obligated to tell the men you're sleeping with regularly that you're not sleeping with them exclusively. There are no exceptions to this rule, ever, for anyone, under any circumstances. People have the right to know if the people they are fucking are also fucking other people. This is the only way the people fucking people who are fucking other people can make emotionally healthy decisions about their lives. It's clean, it's right, it's honest, and it's a basic tenet of Sugar's hard-earned, didn't-do-it-the-right-way-the-first-time-around ethical code to loving others as well as loving oneself. Plus, it seems like breaking this news is going to be rather easy, man juggler. It sounds to me that the men on your current roster of lovers already know that you aren't sleeping with them exclusively. And yet, if they all knew this, why would you ask the question? Best be sure to slip it in rather soon. You don't have to be overly specific, or get all heavy and doe-eyed and like, we really have to talk. Just say, hey, Bill, / friendly ex, / new romping partner I have acquired since I wrote that question to Sugar. This has been super fun, and I want you to know that I'm seeing other people too. Then smile, just a little, and perhaps run your hand very lightly up his dreamy hunk of hairy man arm. Okay, now, on to your question about how to navigate the strange and magical world of casual non-monogamous dating. I think it's excellent that you're having fun sleeping with people you like but don't love, who stimulate you both sexually and intellectually. And it's even better that this new and likely temporary era of your sex life is helping you discover a previously unexplored side of yourself. So that's all peachy, right? What's not so peachy is this business about how you feel, quote, completely overwhelmed by the prospect of juggling these different men. The beauty of your situation, man juggler, is that you don't have to juggle. Just because you can fuck a different man every night of the week doesn't mean you should. One of the basic principles of every single art form has to do not with what's there, the music, the words, the movement, the dialogue, the paint, but with what isn't. In the visual arts, it's called the negative space, the blank parts around and between objects, which is, of course, every bit as crucial as the objects themselves. The negative space allows us to see the non-negative space in all its glory and gloom, its color and mystery and light. What isn't there gives what's there meaning. Imagine that. Sex with 3 different guys on 3 consecutive nights? It's too much paint. Don't do it again. Not because I told you so, but because you told me so when you used the phrases headspin and nervous breakdown in reference to that 3-day run. Listen to yourself and have fun. Yours, Sugar. Tiny Revolutions. Dear Sugar, I'm a woman in my mid-50s. I read your column regularly and believe that my question is pedestrian, but I'm humbly asking for your advice and support anyway, as I sit in the pain of it all. After a couple decades of marriage, my husband and I are separating. I'm at peace with it as I feel my marriage has essentially been dead for a while. My husband never was demonstrative emotionally or physically. I have spent many years feeling horribly lonely. No amount of trying to get from him what I needed brought change. It took a lot for me to finally believe that I was worthy of more and to make a step toward that possibility. Of course, the future terrifies me and excites me at the same time. I want to create more loving relationships in my life, both in friendship and romance. I want and need loving touches, loving words. And at the same time, I'm terrified that I'll never feel the tender touch of a man. Yesterday, as a friend was telling me about a wonderful, intimate moment with his partner, I was frightened that I would never have that in my life. I worry about sex. I haven't been with another man for a long time. The sex in my marriage was routine and uninspiring. At one point, I told my husband I wanted to have sex more often, and he made a joke of it the next night. And I'm afraid I'm not very good at it. I would orgasm regularly with my husband, so it isn't that. We hid behind what worked until it got to be boring. For years, I imagined robust, adventurous sex, and yet I would allow the routine to continue. I'm afraid that I will meet a man that I connect with and will have sex, and I will not be any good in bed. I need help. How does one go about changing that before it's too late? And then there is the issue of my body. With clothes on, I'm presentable. Without clothes, my body reveals the story of significant weight gain and significant weight loss. I feel good about losing weight, but naked my body is droopy, and I'm embarrassed by it. I try to imagine how I will be present sexually with all of my insecurities in that department. Surgery is expensive and out of my means. My doctor says without it, my skin won't regain the same tightness. I imagine orchestrating ways to keep from being seen, but I know that probably won't work, and I'm so afraid of how a potential lover will react. I don't want to hide behind my fear, and yet I'm so very frightened of exposing myself. I know you can't do it for me, sugar, and yet I feel so alone in this place of fear. Are there men my age who date women my age who will be accepting of my body? I know you really don't have the answer, but I ask anyway. Emotionally, I'm very brave. Sexually and being vulnerable with my body, I'm not so much, but want to be. And of course, I'm equally terrified that I won't have the opportunity to express myself and challenge myself in that way. Please help. Signed, Wanting. Dear Wanting, when my daughter was 5, she overheard me complaining to Mr. Sugar that I was a big, fat, ugly beast who looks terrible in everything. And immediately she asked with surprise, "You're a big, fat, ugly beast who looks terrible in everything?" "No, I was only joking," I exclaimed in a falsely cheerful tone. Then I proceeded to pretend, for the sake of my daughter's future self-esteem, that I did not believe myself to be a big, fat, ugly beast who looks terrible in everything. My impulse is to do the same for you, Wanting. In order to protect you from a more complicated reality, I want to pretend that droopy-fleshed women in deep middle age are lusted after by droves of men for their original and seasoned beauty. "Looks don't matter," I want to shout in a giddy you-go-girl tone. It wouldn't be a lie. Looks really don't matter. You know they don't. I know they don't. All the sweet peas of Sugarland would rise and ratify that statement. And yet, but still, we know it's not entirely true. Looks matter to most of us, and sadly they matter to women to a rather depressing degree, regardless of age, weight, or place on the gorgeous to hideous beauty continuum. I don't need to detail the emails in my inbox from women with fears such as your own as proof. I need only to do a quick accounting of just about every woman I've ever known, an endless phalanx of mostly attractive females who were freaked out because they were fat or flat-chested or frizzy-haired, or oddly shaped, or lined with wrinkles, or laced with stretch marks, or in some other way imperfect when viewed through the distorted eyes of the all-knowing, woman-annihilating, ruthless beauty god who has ruled and sometimes doomed significant portions of our lives. I say, enough of that. Enough of that. I've written often about how we have to reach hard in the direction of the lives we want, even if it's difficult to do so. I've advised people to set healthy boundaries and communicate mindfully and take risks and work hard on what actually matters and confront contradictory truths and trust the inner voice that speaks with love and shut out the inner voice that speaks with hate. But the thing is, the thing that so many of us forget is that those values and principles don't only apply to our emotional lives. We've got to live them out in our bodies too. Yours, mine, droopy and ugly and fat and thin and marred and wretched as they are. We have to be as fearless about our bellies as we are with our hearts. There isn't a shortcut around this. The answer to your conundrum isn't finding a way to make your future lover believe you look like Angelina Jolie. It's coming to terms with the fact that you don't, and never will. A fact, I'd like to note,